come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast, and today we have two of Preservation Maryland's team members with us, which is the organization that powers PreserveCast. And we are talking, I know that Christy has been with us before on the podcast. On multiple occasions, we've talked about preservation films, and we've also talked about presidential burial sites. And I can't remember, I think this is Maggie's debut on PreserveCast. So we have Maggie Pelta-Pauls with us. Both of them do work within Preservation Maryland. Maggie's work focuses actually on project management associated with historic buildings themselves. Christy works, obviously, kind of engaging the community around preservation and then also managing our historic preservation grant program. But for today's purposes, we're going to be talking about researching a historic home or a property and what it takes to do that. They both just conducted a public program on this, so they're fresh off of that program. And I guess the big question, and maybe I'll throw this to Christy first, is how did we get here? Why is this of value? Why is it something that we're focusing on? Why would a preservation group even care about this?
Excellent. Again, thank you for having me back. It's lovely being here. Well, how we got here as far as me and Maggie working together to put on some programming and put together a property research guide was that I'm still new to Maryland. So I'm still figuring out how we actually research things here. I was mentioning some stuff to Maggie, and she said in passing that she was working on a blog post of a similar topic. So she knew some things that I never heard of before. I knew some things that she never heard of before. So we joined forces and worked on this together. But the bigger question of why it's important to research your property, I think a lot of the times when we're doing preservation, you know, obviously the architecture of a building is very important, and you have to do the research of the property to figure out how that building was constructed and how it evolved and was changed over time. But just as important is the social history of that site as well, how the building was used, why those changes were made, and how the building played a part in the greater community. And that can only be attained by doing that deeper level research into the building and the people that lived there.
Maggie, maybe I'll throw it over to you. Do you have like a real world example of how this has played out, whether it be hidden history or just sort of connecting story to place in a way that you've worked on recently?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and thank you for having me on the PreserveCast. I am excited to be here for the first time. So when we were researching the history of the Berlin House, which is a project that we're working on with the city of Brunswick, you know, we knew that broader history of Brunswick, that it was a railroad town. We kind of have this like overall sketch of what the story was. But when we started digging into the history of the house, you know, we were able to find things like obituaries, and we can kind of see how these like real lives actually intersected with that railroad history. So we found out that it was actually owned by a woman, Mary McDonald, who ran that as a boarding house for people who worked on the railroad. So we actually kind of see how, you know, there's this relationship between the built environment, the stories of the people who live there, and the larger community that kind of occupied that space.
And didn't the research uncover that she like had some special like baked good that she was known for or something?
Yeah, I can double check, but I think she was known for they were like apple hand pies or something like that.
I feel like at the opening day of that site, yes, once it's done, we have to have apple hand pies. I think that's...
And people who were like high up in the railroad, when they came out to Brunswick, they like sought her out for that.
I would.
She was really well known.
So, Christy, you mentioned you're new to Maryland, but not new to preservation. Previously, you were in Buffalo. Examples of this where research laid the groundwork for some proactive preservation?
Right. So in Buffalo, New York, there is a historic district called Hamlin Park, a historically Black neighborhood that had been successfully landmarked on the local level many years ago. And then once historic tax credits came around, they wanted to get it designated on the national level so they could have access to that. But it wasn't going well. The assessment from the National Park Service and the State Preservation Office was that there was too many issues with the integrity, specifically that too many of the buildings, you know, it's a turn of the century kind of neighborhood with craftsman-ish style houses, that kind of jazz right there. And a lot of those porches, those original wood porches, had been removed and replaced with various types of ironwork replacement. And so there were just so many of those porches that had those changes that they felt that the integrity of the neighborhood was not enough. So the consultants working on that nomination, you know, went back and did more research and uncovered that there was actually a financial incentive program, a part of, you know, a broader urban renewal program, that actually they had money and they went door to door and they realized that the porches were things that were falling apart and that homeowners didn't have the money to repair. And so they found funding so that they could replace their deteriorating original porches with these iron pieces. So because of that extra research that they found and uncovering that narrative, those things that originally were seen as negatives on their integrity were then part of the significance of that neighborhood. And that's what solidified their ability to secure that National Register status. So again, the power of research and the social history of an individual site or neighborhood can, you know, affect in these preservation planning decisions.
Yeah. So there's some real world implications here for how this impacts things, not just learning about, you know, this unique stories, which is important, but also it can impact things as specific as tax credits. So let's take a sort of a step-by-step approach to how this is done. So for somebody who's really not familiar with this, maybe we'll start with Christy here and then we'll kind of go back and forth as we talk through this. But how do you sort of frame this kind of research? Where do you start, Christy?
Yeah, I think the first thing is you kind of want to set up the framework of your property, the bones of the narrative of your property or your site. And that's through deeds and maps. So you want to complete a full chain of title on your property. You want to investigate all the different maps that exist, municipal and otherwise, so you can figure out a visual timeline of your property over time. When you're researching those types of documents, you want to make sure that you're starting with the present day and working backwards. You want to understand what your baseline is. What is the current dimensions of that property lot? What are the current names of the streets? What the current house number is? You know, what its current location, you know, on the block. Is it the third building in? Is it across the street from this type of building, so that as you're going backwards in time, you're always comparing to that original description to make sure that you're following the correct building backwards. And then by there, creating that full chain of title, that full timeline of the building, that all the other research that you're going to pull is going to fill in the blanks in between those documents.
And it can be hard to identify exactly when a structure was constructed.
Yes.
Right. Particularly if they're really old. So if you're talking about something like, you know, 1780s, you're probably looking for like a jump in price at some point, but that can be a big swing in timeline. So you have to use multiple clues. You probably just be in the land records. It'll be part land record, part architectural observation, or maybe even something more intense down the road. But, That can be a challenging part too with really old things.
Oh, for sure. And that's why getting that chain of title and all of those available maps right at the start will help you figure out those blurry areas and just give you that baseline, so that when there are these questions, you can try to, you know, at least zero in, you know, especially for really, really older houses where there isn't a document that literally says we started building the building today, or there isn't like an actual permit document submitted, we started today. But that chain of title and that map timeline will be that base for you to kind of fill in and figure out the squiggly stuff.
And then I guess the other side of that too, and I'm just asking things about things I've seen, is sometimes people get, we're just talking about the deed stuff and the maps, we'll get confused because there will be a deed for their property that, you know, in Maryland could be I don't know, we'll just make it up, 1712. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, well, my house must be from 1712.
Right. That's super common. And especially another really common thing, you know, there's lots of famous people who were presidents of banks. And sometimes back in the day, those people would be the ones signing it. So again, I just came from Buffalo and Millard Fillmore, a president, was a president of a bank. And so there's deeds in Buffalo where he's signed them. And so then people think that he owned their house, and that's not true. But just, you know, the deed, it's important to keep in mind the deed is for the land, right? So the land has been sold since we started that convention here. And so just because there is a deed doesn't necessarily mean that there is a property on that land, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's your property that you're looking up. So again, that chain of title just gives you the framework of who are the people that own that land. So then you can hunt down and know the names you need to look for in the other documents to see if there's more data that gives you that information of, is there a building? Is it my building?
So maybe we'll go over to Maggie. Where are the other documents? What else should we be looking for?
You mean as opposed, like, aside from deeds and maps?
Well, yeah. So we've got our deeds and maps for this property that we're researching. What else should we be looking for, and how should we organize it?
So yeah, just to underscore what Christy said, like, once you have that really organized chain of title and you've got it in chronological order and you know the names that you're looking for, it really sets you up for success when you go to look in the census records and you go to look at newspaper records. You can really be able to say, you know, the exact time frame to look at. So, you know, a lot of these databases that we use, they're massive. They search from, you know, 1700, 1800 to the present. So you can narrow down, well, I know that John Doe owned this property from 1800 to 1850. So that really allows you to be able to pull the precise names, be really targeted in your search, and then you can search through the newspapers, search through the census records for those different people and learn a little bit more about kind of the social history, the who lived there. One of the nice things and interesting things about census records and newspapers as well, and kind of these ephemeral documents, is that they will also tell you who lived there, who didn't own the property, who didn't have capital attached to their name. Because a lot of times those people lived there maybe their whole lives or for a long chunk of their lives, but they never owned that land. And so the newspapers can really illuminate those stories for us, which I found to be particularly rewarding when we were doing this research, for instance, on the Berlin House. That's how we found out that there were borders, because there were borders listed in the census.
Right. So if we had just looked at the legal documents, we just thought that Mary lived there all by herself. But Maggie was able to find that, no, she had this bustling business and was this key woman that all the railroad men knew about. That would never have been discovered if we just stuck to the government documents available.
So talk to me about, we've mentioned a couple of different places. Where do you pull this stuff? So people listening are like, well, and we have people listening all across the country, obviously. So we were just sort of using Maryland and I guess New York examples. But where are they going to find this? Do they need to subscribe to something? Where is a lot of this material found?
In Maryland, a lot of it is digitized. It's on a website called marylandlandrecords.net. And it's a free, you just have to have an account. It's free to access. And it's really amazing. We are so, so, so lucky to have all of that centralized for us. If you need to access a document in person, you will still go to your local, like, county clerk to access those documents. And that happened, especially if something's not digitized and it says like page missing, you will have to go to the local office to find that. In other states, it depends. For instance, in the city of Beacon, to get some of this stuff, you have to submit a Freedom of Information request. In the state of Virginia, you have to pay to access digital subscriptions, to access digitized land records. In Maryland, we are so lucky to have all of it free and accessible for us. In terms of things like newspapers and the census records, the Library of Congress has a lot of census records, things like Ancestry.com, Heritage Quest, they also have a lot of census records, and often your local library will provide you with access if you have a library card. But things like newspapers.com and bigger sort of search engines like that, they do require a subscription, but they are really, really incredible, powerful websites.
And as you said, a lot of times your local library will have, you might have to use it at there. Or I even know, like, some of the libraries, like our system that we use here in Maryland, in our county, like, there you can access newspapers.com for free. So you just have to kind of go in through their system and use your library card and things like that. So people listening should try and do it free to start. Don't feel like you have to sign up for every service. Yeah. But I do think that is a confusion where people think that you have to pay for a lot of this information, whereas most of it's free. You just have to know how to dig for it.
Yes. No, there's tons of free information out there. And again, like your public libraries, your college libraries, your historical societies, a lot of those kinds of organizations have research rooms, and those rooms were started before we started digitizing these documents. So become friends with your librarian, become friends with your local archivist. Like, they know what their collections are. They know what they have. So I know it is so easy to pull and find so many things online, and there are ways to get them for free online, but there is a wealth of information hiding away in your local library that your librarian can help you out finding. And then again, all of those institutions, and we found that here in Maryland, I found that in every state that I've worked in so far as well, where they've created their own finding guides and indexes for what's in their collection, and giving you kind of the walkthrough of how to navigate their system. So yeah, definitely rely on libraries, pro libraries.
Yeah, the Maryland State Archive was totally invaluable to us in this search, and all of their archivists were just so helpful, willing to answer any question we had. I don't think we could have done it without them.
And so, Christy, now let's say we're in a database, or we're in some type of archive, and we're trying to search, maybe we've identified through the census record that a person by a certain name lived in the property that we're researching, and we're trying to learn more about them. Talk to us about how we use search terms within resources, and if there's any advice when it comes to that.
Right, sure. So I think, today there's a lot of standardization with how we talk about people and the titles that we use and things like that. That is a brand new thing that did not exist throughout the lifetime of the United States. So when you're searching through newspapers and even census documents, you have to really kind of rack your brain and explore like all the different ways that you can use terminologies. There's not going to be a consistency in the way that a name is formatted. You know, one newspaper is going to call people by, Mr., Miss, and then the last name. Other newspapers are going to not use that terminology. There's also, a thing with, these kinds of weird rules of decorum and politeness that we used to have that maybe we don't have anymore, where today in newspapers, they will say in point blank language, whatever event happened, and clearly describe it because it's a newspaper. But back in the day, there's a lot of euphemisms and skirting around topics, especially if during your research, you find something that is a nefarious or unsettling news. You know, there is a crime that happened associated with your property or people in your property. It's not going to say point blank what that issue was. So you have to really kind of think about how would they talk about it then. Another big thing to keep in mind is that as magical as these websites and this digitizing these records are, it's still, AI is still learning how to read these documents. And the typefaces that we use back in the day can sometimes be tricky for the computers to read, especially when you have letters like X and Z and Y. Each typeface is going to write that letter a little differently. And the AI might not find that word while you're searching. I worked on a project that involved a woman whose name was Eliza. And every time I went into newspapers.com, I found new newspapers that I never found before because it finally could figure out that that was a Z and not a different letter. And then another example I'll say as far as naming as well, and specifically about women, is that for a significant period of history, women were never actually mentioned by their name unless it was a police address, a arrest warrant or something in that nature. They were almost always mentioned by their husband's name. So again, if we're talking about a woman who is Jane Doe, she's not going to be listed as Mrs. Jane Doe. She's going to be listed as Mrs. her husband's name. So again, you might know one person in your house, but you need to understand who everybody is in that house so that you can properly investigate that.
Which then, we're kind of headed in the direction of just finding weird stuff, which is, this is hand pies and all that kind of stuff. Those are the quirky things, but then there's even weirder things that you're going to come across. like in Baltimore City, you might find ground rents.
Ooh, I'll take this one. This is my favorite topic.
What is a ground rent?
A ground rent is the situation where, and it's much more common in the greater Baltimore area, very much in the city, sometimes in the county, some other parts of this the state as well, but primarily around Baltimore, where someone could own the land, but not the house, that those ownerships have been separated. And that started in the colonial period as a way to keep housing affordable. It was an affordable housing measure so that you just had to pay for the house, which would be way cheaper than buying that really expensive land. A lot of properties by now have consolidated and have purchased their ground rent, so they own the whole entire thing outright. But a lot of properties have yet to do that. And even for those properties that have done that, when you're going back and doing your deed research, there will be periods where it is separated and it'll be really confusing. When I moved here, I used my apartment as an example to start learning how to navigate the systems. And once I pulled all the deeds, it was a mess. And I did not understand why I had these two threads of ownership. And then I stumbled across what ground rents are. And I realized the language of the deed, how it was describing what was being sold. And oh, that's what that means. So when someone just owns their house, they owe a yearly rent to the person who owns the ground. As payment for having their house on that land.
And as a matter of like, just out of curiosity, how often was it actually paid?
It was, it would say in the deed, it would specify in the deed and tell that person buying the house, you know, this house is subject to a ground rent of, I've seen anywhere from a couple of bucks to $300-$400. And it usually was paid biannually. And they would say the specific months in your deed when it was due. And then if you didn't pay that, in the ground rent deeds, it describes what that owner, you know, the recourse that the owner has and what that process is. If it's not paid by this date, then I can do this X, Y, and Z to, you know, to get that money from that person and whatever that process is.
So that's a weird one that you might find.
It's a weird one.
Maggie, do you have any other strange ones you want to kind of talk about?
I don't know about anything as strange as ground rents in particular. That is quite a unique legal feature. But I think I'm always surprised by what I find. That's something I have to say. And that's like one of the great joys of doing this kind of research. You never know what you're going to get. You know, I grew up in a house that was kind of a traditional 1960s suburb. And I thought to myself, there'll be nothing. How would this be interesting? It was built, you know, in the 60s. How wrong I was. I found out that the man who owned what eventually became that subdivision was this Wall Street banker who had a tumultuous life. And he, you know, he became known as the Alimony King because he had such a public divorce from his wife, and it was all over the newspapers. So he was so well known, and you know that his name is his namesake. It's the namesake of all the streets. So I drive down these streets every day. You know, when I go home to visit my family, and I just think, oh, that's my street name. But actually, it's attached to this man who had quite the life. So I actually think that, you know, you can go into this, you know, just saying, I'm just going to research my house. I just want to know maybe when it was built, or, you know, I do want to make a register listing or something like that. But what you come away with is going to be so, so much more than just that chronology. It's a really exciting thing to do, I think.
And then Christy, there's also covenants that you might come across. Talk to us about the kind of covenants. And obviously we're talking about Maryland and, you know, but there, you're going to see different things all across the country.
Yeah. So, you know, more on the unfortunate side of things, you know, there's going to be covenants that are going to be, you know, innocuous kind of stuff, just saying that you can only build certain types of buildings on it. You know, a lot of times in suburban areas and suburban planned developments, it'll say in the deed that only a single family home can be built on it, that no businesses can operate from it, those types of things. But then there's also racial covenants. And so you'll see some really upsetting language where it says straight up in your deed that Black people are not allowed to own this property, or Jewish people are not allowed to own this property. Sometimes that's included right in the deed and is repeated over and over again every time it's sold until you know, it was thankfully removed once that is obviously illegal. Sometimes that document is a separate agreement that is made. And I recently saw that here in the city of Buffalo, where there's no racial covenants in the actual deeds for the property. But at one period of time, all of the neighbors on the block got together and signed an agreement that none of them would allow Black people to own their homes. And subsequent deeds would reference how there's this other document that applies to the property, but it never actually said what it was in the deed. So it wasn't until I went and pulled up that document that I realized, you know, what that was.
Where would you find that type of document? Where is that agreement going to be filed? Is that filed in the courthouse too?
Yeah, no? That would be filed with the land records as well. And because it is, you know, impacting the land sales, you know, it should be referenced in all subsequent deeds because you want those people to follow through on that. I mean, if that's your prerogative. So, you know, there's that kind of thing. And then for older properties that are being sold and operating, you know, under chattel slavery during that time period, you're also going to need to, you know, those records are often separated, even though they are all ownership documents, all, you know, land records type stuff. A lot of those, and again, each state, each community is going to organize it slightly differently, but you'll have your regular deed that's mainly about the house, but then you'll also have another place that you might need to go that'll also have land records that'll note how the humans that were the enslaved people that were also sold with that property. So those records might not necessarily be very, very specified in the traditional deed, but that's still a really important part of the narrative that we need to bring light to. So again, depending on where you are and how the documents are stored, make friends with your clerk and your librarian so you can figure out where those things are. You do want to make sure that you're checking for those records as well.
And that's also like probate records where...
Oh, yeah.
People, you know, when you die with a will and then that will is adjudicated and probated, then particularly as you go back and they had really intense personal property taxes,
right?
You can find out what, and that's a lot of times how historic house museums know what was in there is they have sort of a record, but also sort of on that unfortunate side buried within there, particularly, you know, in Antebellum South, you will find if there were enslaved people owned by that family, sometimes they will be listed within that property as well. So that is another place to look. And those aren't always digitized. I think it's sort of hit or miss, particularly as you go way back.
And those are considered court records. So depending on the time period that that happened, you might not be able to get access to that because there are, especially for probate records, there is kind of that time period of protection if you know, there's like a time limit on it, like you can't be looked at or made digitized a certain amount of time. So some of those you have to go in person. So yeah, when you do your chain of title and you see a blip in it and it doesn't make sense, it's often because the ownership was settled in the probate and that it wasn't like a deed that was filed. It was settled in probate. And that's where they said that the building was given to the cousin or the son or whatever.
Right.
You'll most often in the deed records see that a building is being sold by a trustee or an executor. So then you'll know and it'll reference whatever probate in that deed. So then you can go and find those court records to get all the juicy details of who was fighting over what.
So as Maggie said, there's always something weird to find. And that is, you know, that's part of the challenge and also part of the intrigue of kind of looking into these places. And as we said at the very outset, not only is there just the satisfaction of knowing more about a place and knowing more about the people that made these places interesting and significant and historic and, you know, imbued them with the character that they have, but there's also real world implications of historic tax credits and zoning decisions and, you know, local designation and all those sorts of things that get tied up in this. And I think all too often we think that only a professional can do this kind of work. And a lot of this kind of work with a little bit of determination can be done behind, you know, a laptop screen. And there's a lot to learn there. From either of you, we'll probably do both, actually. Any parting words of wisdom? We'll go to Maggie and then we'll come back to Christy.
I would say that to approach this process with an open mind. There was a lot for me to learn. And I was very lucky to have Christy as a teacher and a guide through this first research process. But it is very much a learning process. You won't necessarily know all the different idiosyncrasies of your state when you start out. But you'll learn them and it will be fun and it will be interesting. And I think if you are able to keep track of all those things, it will definitely make it easier down the line. And I'm sure you'll find some really exciting things in your research.
Yeah, it definitely underscores everything that she just said, especially how amazing I am at researching things. I think my biggest thing is organization. Again, I know that a lot of people take this on as a fun side pursuit, and I'm not trying to say that you need to treat it as, you know, doing your PhD dissertation or something, but very rarely is it a nice, easy path to figuring out. Like that's not the most common thing. It's more often that like things get weird and you got to like really twist your brain to figure out, okay, well, I know what this, how do I figure out the rest of it? So being organized is so important, and making sure that you're keeping things, you know, having the date associated with your different facts and keeping, you know, in chronological order and keeping track of what types of documents that you're looking at. So that you're making sure that you're not skipping things, and that you are exploring all of the types of documents that you can explore. And also, you know, the time thing is really important because especially for older buildings, there's a lot of flip-flopping these buildings between family members. And you know, we know today that we have a lot of fun little weird things in our tax code and that people do certain things to jump around stuff. They were doing the same exact thing back in the day. And so there's a lot of shenanigans that we don't understand because our laws are totally different now, but we see the results of that and the remnants of that. And so by being super organized, we'll, you know, make searching easier.
So stay organized, keep an open mind, and beware of shenanigans.
Yeah, lots of shenanigans.
Lots of shenanigans. Well, this has been very, very cool. And I think eye-opening and hopefully helpful for people thinking about doing this, so sort of a little mini guide for people interested in researching their historic home and their historic property. And we'll have to have both of you back and talk about something else in the future. Thanks for joining us, both of you.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening and keep on preserving.